The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Hey, welcome along. It is 11 a.m. North American Eastern Time. It is midday in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, half past noon in Newfoundland and Labrador and beyond the Americas, 4 p.m. in London and Dublin, 5 p.m. Paris and Berlin, 6 p.m. Istanbul and Jerusalem, 7 p.m. in the Trucial States, as I shall always think of them, and 7:30 p.m. in Kabul, for all you Newfoundlanders who move to Afghanistan for the half-hour time zone. Wherever you are on this turbulent planet of ours, I welcome you to another Clubland Q&A. Always great to have new members. Hart Leonard says, brand new subscriber, it does in fact appear that intelligent, engaging conservative talk radio died with Rush. The sooner these ersatz childish Rush replacements, all of them, are off the air, the better. Conservative analysis has devolved to, did you hear what Jen Psaki said on this or that? Or do you think that Joe Biden has dementia, etc., etc.? But did we conservatives over the years become a bit too enamored with our talk radio? Didn't we treat Rush's show and others more like safety blankets instead of calls to righteous action? Our motivations from talk radio seemed limited to emails and texts to each other. I.e., did you hear what Rush said? Did you hear Hannity's interview with this one or that one? Boy, Levin sure was on fire last night, and so on and so on. These shows were always preaching to the choir. There were no mass conversions of leftist progressives to conservatism. So now, looking back over the many years of Rush's show, I use Rush's show only as an example, I am forced to question the tangible impact of talk radio. Rush and others would periodically pronounce the death of the mainstream media. No one's watching the broadcast news. The New York Times is dying. CNN has fewer viewers than the Elm Street Middle School production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Nevertheless, a tremendous amount of talk radio airtime was refuting what the Times said or what CNN reported or how the Huffington Post got it wrong. And all the CNNs, the NYTs, the WAPOs, the MSNBCs are all still there cranking out their Marxist globalist improbities. My question, therefore, did we all become too reliant on and overly complacent from talk radio? Will conservative talk radio eventually wither and die away, thus dooming AM radio for good? Well, I'll tell you this. Talk radio has changed since Rush has died, because Rush set the agenda. Rush came on and told you what was serious. And we now have a situation where people don't come on and take their cue from Rush and do what Rush was talking about in their own way, or take it on a step from Rush. Rush very much set the agenda. And what you notice, I think, is that a lot of people are just talking trivialities. It can be quite amusing. It can be quite diverting. Jen Psaki's funny. So if you have a certain facility and you can do a funny Jen Psaki voice, you can get a couple of laughs out of Jen Psaki. I said on Rush a couple of times over the years I guest hosted that as I got older, I was less and less interested in stuff that wouldn't be important 6 weeks from now. That I was interested in talking about the things that will be important 6 years from now, or even 6 decades from now. But the stuff that's just like funny on the hamster wheel and isn't in the least bit funny, because no one remembers what the origin of the joke was 6 weeks from now, I have less and less interest in. I used to say that. And Rush, to be fair, this was why Rush was always a first principles guy. And that was important to him, that he always liked to. He was like good lawyers. I'm not thinking in the American sense, but barristers elsewhere in the common law world, whose thing is always to look at things from first principles, and Rush did. And I am astonished just how, without Rush to set the bar, the standard has fallen pretty dramatically and pretty quickly on talk radio. The reactive thing, you know, the just reacting to what the particular headline, what, you know, what Rachel Maddow said on MSNBC, what was going on CNN, what was going on Jen Psaki. I've given up on the reactive stuff myself. I did something this morning that I used to do every day, which is I used to get up, start the day by reading the papers. And I don't bother doing that in the same way because I find you just tend to think of yourself then and what you do in oppositional terms. Now, for example, I found a story in the, just like browsing through the New York Times, and this was the lead. Let me see if I can find it here. This was the lead in the science section of the New York Times. Now, it's actually a medical story. And you would think, for example, that there is general interest in medical topics now because of this thing called the virus. Have you heard of this thing that's been like going around the world for the last year and a half? And there are millions of dead people. And it's caused a big change in almost every aspect of daily life. So there are medical stories of general interest. But this is the medical story of general interest to the New York Times. The lead story in its science section today by Rachel Gross called "Even the G-Spot is Named for a Man. Why do so many female body parts honour male scientists?" And she's complaining, as a woman, that many bits and pieces in her, such as Alcock's canal and the pouch of Douglas, are all named after the men who discovered them on one night when they got really lucky in 1798. For example, the fallopian tube was discovered by Gabriele Fallopio, an Italian. And like many Italian explorers, he took the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria up the vaginal canal, and they'd been there for months on end, hadn't seen anything, and he suddenly goes, "Holy hell, what the hell is that up a front, up there?" And it turns out to be the fallopian tube, and so he gets naming rights on the fallopian tube. And this G-spot, don't ask me what it is, I've never been within a mile of it. That's how much I care. And it's called, where's this G? The G-spot is named after Ernst Grafenberg, a German gynecologist. And if you're like an angry feminist, you don't want to be lying there thinking of Ernst Grafenberg. That sounds like it ought to be Ernst von Grafenberg. He probably has a dueling scar and a monocle and a bald head, some Prussian Gauleiter. You don't want to be thinking of Count Ernst von Grafenberg every time anybody gets anywhere near your G-spot, which fortunately isn't terribly often. Now, I've just done, what have I done there? I've just done 10 minutes on the old G-spot. And it's easy. You can do it off the top of it. You don't really need a professional. You can ask this ludicrous story of how in the New York Times headline, "Even the G-spot is named for a man." What is... Now, if you're on talk radio, you just do like jokes about whatever he was called, Giuseppe Fallopi, being on the up the vaginal canal for months on end. Finally, sighted. He's got higher. He's got farther up there than anybody's ever gotten, and he's finally discovered the fallopian tube. Now, you can just do that as a kind of oppositional, reactive thing to the patent absurdity of the New York Times piece. But for me, what's always interesting is the big picture. Now, the medium-sized picture is that this woman who wrote this story, Rachel Gross, is totally out of it because, of course, you know, there aren't female body parts anymore. Now a man can have a fallopian tube. I probably got one myself, just acquired it, didn't notice it. When she says that it's outrageous that she has to have all her body parts named for men who didn't even have these body parts, who is she to say that Gabriele Fallopio didn't have a fallopian tube? Who is she to say that this guy, Count Ernst von Grafenberg, didn't have his own G-spot? Because now the official position of everyone who thinks correctly is that a man or a woman can have a G-spot and a fallopian tube. So that's the middle. That's the middle point. That's when you pull it back, not just to mocking the New York Times, but actually looking at the real underlying story here, which is the left's abolition of biological sex, which is a big deal. And then if you bring the picture further back, if you zoom out further so that you can see the New York Times newsroom over here in the top right-hand corner, and then a little further away, let's zoom out a bit more. Oh, yes, down here at the bottom, there's this river called the Rio Grande. And there's this bridge at a town called Del Rio. What's that? Oh, yes, that's the collapse of America while the America's newspaper of record is complaining about the names of female body parts. So the big picture here is the death of Western civilization and this particularly stupid example of it, which is a good reason why we lost in Afghanistan, among it. Oh, I see. Oh, while we're also covering the news stories, looky here. It's only been 3 weeks since the Yanks fled Kabul. And here we have a fella called, what is this guy's name? Let me see. Barula Nouri. He's at Fort McCoy, Wisconsin. He's one of these many, many trusty, plucky Afghan translators we helped get out of Afghanistan. Because the average American soldier apparently requires 37 translators per GI to function in. Oh, you don't want to pay any attention to what Hakim say. I know, pay no attention to Hakim. Pay attention to me, Barula. Barula Nouri. So we get Barula Nouri out of Afghanistan. That was 3 weeks ago. 4 weeks ago, if he was on one of the early flights. He's already been charged with 3 counts of attempting to rape a minor. Okay? Now, I talked about this... a couple of whatever it was, a few weeks back, a few months back, talking about when I was in Norway and I spent an afternoon in the delightful company of a charming Norwegian lady as she attempted to teach the Afghan refugees not to rape Norwegian women, because their way of courtship is, oh, look at that beautiful infidel whore showing all her erogenous parts, all her erotic zones. And of course, when all the women are in burqas, then everything about a woman is an erogenous zone. Look at her erogenous elbow. I've never seen a bare elbow. And my way, you know, you say the Norwegian way is to invite her to dinner and perhaps bring her in a corsage and then take her back to your pad and play Johnny Mathis LPs. And I say, to hell with that. I just drag her into the shrubbery and rape her. And I said I was sympathetic to these guys because I talked to them. I talked to a lot of these Afghan, not just ones who'd undergone this course, but ones who were just like hanging out at bus stations. And they were quite upfront about the way you're like, it's like to them, it's like walking through a brothel. You're surrounded by women in a state of undress that you have never seen. These Scandinavian blondes in shorts with their long, sporty legs. And it's just like, it's just like ramming sex down your throat all day long. Well, now here we go. Barula Nouri of Fort McCoy, Wisconsin. He hasn't been in Wisconsin more than 3 weeks and he's up for 3 counts of trying to rape a child. Because I'm a genuine multiculturalist, which involves understanding that cultures are different. All the multiculturalists just think, oh, every culture is the same. It's a one big uniculture. When we talk about the patriarchy, a 1950s sitcom dad is no different from a big bearded mullah in Jalalabad. It's rubbish. But when I listen, now to come back to what we were talking about, which is Hart's question here. When I listen to talk radio, I never actually hear any of the big picture stuff. Now, this isn't true. I, as I've said before, I like Harry Carr and I like a few others and all the rest of it. But for the most part, I don't listen to it because it's all so obvious, mocking Jen Psaki or whoever it is, you know. And it has the same problem as the general establishment, right, in that it's not actually articulating a position. Now, Hart is wrong. There are a lot of people who were converted to conservatism by Rush. And if you try to imagine the last 30 years without Rush, where do you think conservatism actually would be? People wouldn't. It would be like, to a certain extent, it was in the late 1950s, where it wasn't even a thing. You weren't even aware of it. At least now it's a minority thing. It's a weird, kinky, fringe fetish. But it wouldn't even be that if it weren't for people like Rush keeping conservative ideas in the game and actually advancing them, moving the ball. Now, I don't hear that on so-called conservative talk radio today. I don't hear much talk about the big picture. I'm not interested in 2022 because 2022 just means Kevin McCarthy will be leader of the House and whoop-de-doo. You know, the Republicans, so-called, had control of the House, the Senate, and the Oval Office for 2 years, and they did bugger all with it. Because they never talk about anything. You go, if you want to be bored to death, if you're having difficulty sleeping at night, try going to the House Republicans' Twitter feed. Anyway, Hart, I do thank you for that first question. I don't want to sound, you know, people will say, well, you didn't get the gig, so that's how shows how much they thought of you and all the rest of it. No, I enjoyed all my years guest hosting for Rush, and I realized during the last year when the guest hosting was getting more and more frequent that to do that well is really far more difficult than it sounds. And I felt as well that it in that slot it deserves an American. It shouldn't have some, you know, I used to joke about being the undocumented anchorman, but really, you know, American conservatism shouldn't have reached the stage that you can't find a full-blown native red-blooded American who can take the baton from Rush, which is what it's not no secret. I don't know whether I've said it on air, but I certainly said it to everyone involved with these things, that it's something that for a red-blooded American, I don't want to be the Haitian under the bridge at the golden EIB microphone. But I'm simply agreeing with Hart's diagnosis to this extent that I think it's a sort of headless chicken now. Something else will eventually emerge on the evidence of what these programmers, the program directors are doing. And don't forget, the program directors aren't in the conservatism business. They're in the radio business. So if conservative talk isn't any good for radio, they'll be playing soft and easy favourites or 23 hippity-hop tracks in a row, if that's not working out. Anyway, I gave a lot of time to that question, so I want to get don't want it to be a one-question show. But I mean what I say about that thing, the business of understanding what is the real story behind the story. You know, we talked about trees and forests last time, and there are lots of trees. And the thing is, you want to pick the tree that exemplifies the forest. That thing, that story in the New York Times, why are all my body parts named after men, is why we're dying. And frankly, why as a civilization, we deserve to die, because we're being utterly trivial and stupid and self-loathing and defeatist. And the idea of, you know, saying, oh, but wait a minute, there's this guy running in the 47th congressional district of New Hampshire who looks like he's talking a good game, and all you have to do is send money now to sendmoneynow.com. The Republican Party, Karl Rove, the PACs, they've got all the money they need. What they don't have is is any ideas that persuade other people. Okay. Al-Man from CA says, Mark, now that it is obvious that the Durham report is a fabulous success, can you pull some of your strings in the President Asterisk administration and get him started on the investigation into the origins of the Wuhan flu? I'm sure the results will be worthwhile info for our descendants when it is released. P.S. I'm rereading Mark Stein from head to toe for my bedtime read, and it is a lot of fun. And reminds me of what the heck was going on way back then. Thank you. Yeah, you know, that's the other thing. As I said, I think it was it last time round or whenever it was, that the right is entirely retroactive. Oh, the left did something to us. Oh, let's investigate it for 6 years. Robert writes, Mark... just after the election, you noted last election, this is the Canadian election, Andrew Scheer was particularly contemptible in the hours before my appearance at the House of Commons Justice Committee, as I may discuss in detail one of these days. Could this be one of these days? Thanks in advance. This is a reference to the Canadian election. As you know, Justin Trudeau is back with another minority ministry. The slogan, and this is... the stupidity of the Canadian Conservative Party, which is, even by the standards of other Conservative parties, almost unbelievably stupid. They ran on the slogan as, no one wanted this election, because the election cost whatever it was, you know, $37 Canadian. There was no demand for it because it was only 2 years since the last election. And so why did he even call the election? We shouldn't be having an election at this time. Well, the implicit message of that is, OK, you want Justin Trudeau to serve out his full term and be prime minister for another couple of years at least. So we'll have a full second Trudeau ministry. So the implication of that is... you're telling people we should have stuck with the status quo. Why are you then surprised when you... You know, here's the... There was... what was that show? BBC show. Radioactive. It was about a terrible radio station. And one of the terrible shows they had was they had... which is very typical. You could hear this on Sunday morning. I think it is on BBC Radio 2. And various other, all kinds of local stations around the British Isles have an equivalent version where there's this like weedy Sunday morning religious show hosted by a vicar who isn't religious at all. And the one on Radioactive was called, I think, The Right Reverend, Reverend Wright. And he used to say, hello, welcome to Sunday morning. And today's show, we have some interesting cooking recipes for Lent. And then we'll be talking to an Afghan refugee about what it's like being brought over to live in a totally racist country. And we'll also be playing you some spiritual new age music every so often. Oh, and there'll be just a little bit of religion, but not to worry, not too much of it. In fact, hardly anything of it at all. And that's the way the Canadian Conservative Party, what, they're embarrassed by religion. The consultants they have... the consultants are essentially liberals. Someone in The Spectator in London this week had a comment that began, The Spectator is a magazine for conservatives edited by liberals. And actually, if you think about it, a lot of conservative institutions in the West are actually like that. Right now, they're embarrassed, totally embarrassed by conservatism. And they don't want to talk about it. Their own inclinations are liberals. The consultants' inclinations are liberals. They mix with liberals. They socialize with liberals. They have the same condescending view. Who was that guy, the American guy who wrote a book on how... apologizing for having been a Republican consultant for the last 40 years. What was he? Was it the guy, the one who lives in Vermont? But the whole thing is that he's saying, oh, for 4 decades, I had to pretend to like these ghastly evangelicals and these all the awful people who like country music. And of course, I couldn't actually sound them. That's basically the subtext of what he's saying. Now, Andrew Scheer, to come back to what you were saying, Andrew Scheer. Yeah, I testified before the House of Commons Justice Committee. It was supposed to be televised. You know, you agree to do these things. I agreed to drive to Ottawa, put up for a couple of nights at the Chateau Laurier, and it's not cheap. So I agreed to appear before this committee. It was supposed to be televised, but then Andrew Scheer put out the word that it wasn't to be televised. He didn't want it televised because then it would attract too much attention. And he didn't want any free speech warriors talking up free speech on the eve of the election. Because what I regard as a principal commitment to free speech, he regards as letting people with strange, weird opinions go around talking about this stuff as if they're representing the conservative movement. And it allows the so-called media to damn the so-called conservative movement as being full of right-wing haters. So he had us nixed from that. Absolutely appalling. And the gutless, I think the chairman of the committee had actually had to quit the day before. So you have conservative leaders who are actually terrified of conservatism, who don't want conservatism, who think that the way to get elected is to be liberal light. And then by the time, so you say, oh, you're just worried at this, like if you get in the car with AOC, she's going to floor it over the cliff. Whereas if you get in the car with Kevin McCarthy, he's just going to drift over the cliff. He'll switch the engine off, but he'll neglect to pull up the parking brake and you'll just slide over the cliff ever so slowly, almost as if it's in slow motion. And that'll be a lot less distressing for you, won't it? And so, and the American system is particularly bad for this because there is no forum in which ideas are discussed. There are no politicians you associate with ideas. When they have these interminable 2-year campaigns for president, all you learn about them is this stupid fake biography, soft focused biography with the crap music that they put on there. You know, and again, don't wave your constitution at me. We're in a post-constitutional order. You must get that. Even you constitutional fetishists must get that. We're beyond the constitution. You know, what we have at the moment, for example, is that we see at the border, the government of the United States, which enforces its laws against you, because just you say, you try breaking the laws the way all the happy Haitians are, and see whether they'll do that. So if you go to a Trump rally on January the 6th and it gets a bit out of hand, on January the 7th, you'll be in solitary confinement, banged up, awaiting your trial in 2-3 years' time or whenever it comes up. So we don't have equality before the law. So the Constitution is bollocks right now. And if you're talking about the Constitution, you might as well be on some sports bro morning show, because the Constitution's gone. There are two choices. You can have a discussion on, well, what do we need to do to get the Constitution back? The Constitution's died. It went into one of Andrew Cuomo's old folks' homes, and they put it on a ventilator, and the Constitution died. But maybe we can all hold hands around the Ouija board and crank it back into life again. Or you can say it's gone and it's never coming back and we've got to figure out what to do next. But constitutional fetishization, just there, lying there with the Constitution, like the woman lying there with the tingling G-spot named after some Prussian count, that may turn you on just as it may turn her on. But it's not going to do any good. It really isn't going to do any good. So the constitutional fetishization, we're in a post-constitutional order. And one of the other things that I also think is relevant to that is that the appeals to American exceptionalism aren't going to get you anywhere either. Because whatever the historical truth of that, right now, whether you look at the United States, the British settler nations, continental Europe, everybody's heading over the cliff. We're all heading to the same destination point, which is the garbage can of history. So it's actually standing around like the right wing radio shows. America, we're not at all like France, not like those poofters in France, Nancy boys in France. We're not. That would be fantastico if it were true. But the reality right now is not so central is America. That stupid article in the New York Times wouldn't have been published in Le Monde. It wouldn't have been published in any major non-English speaking newspaper. You could probably get it in a Canadian newspaper. You could probably get it in New Zealand. But I'm not even sure about that. Right now, the crazy central is America. Mildly less crazy are the British Dominions. So you're talking about your UK, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, because their papers are full of stuff from America. Their universities get infected with stuff from the American universities. So they're second tier crazy. They don't have the money because they don't have the global reserve currency. They don't have the $75,000 a year to go to some crap university and get a worthless degree. They don't have the money to be as quite as crazy as the crazy Yanks, but they'd like to be. They're getting there. And then you get to Western Europe, and nobody, not even the Swedes or the Danes or the most effete pacifist wimpo continentals are as deranged on the woke stuff as America. So again, there's a lesson here for the American right. If you want to save your country, if you want to save your... I'm sorry, I'm getting cranky again. But Rush was a serious person. He was the mayor of Realville. And he didn't whitewash things. And so you can't just be a pom-pom girl and retreat to the same old songs. Oh, Constitution, Constitution, Constitution. Exceptionalism. You can't do that when you're actually galloping into the abyss of doom. You've got to say to yourself, look, it isn't 1776 anymore. Something's happened. We let go, while we were being pom-pom girls for the Constitution, every significant lever, which country am I in? Every significant lever or lever of influence was seized by not just liberalism, but by hardcore, nutso cultural Marxists. So that a cultural Marxist, I should use the term cultural because economic Marxism was a theory more rooted in economic reality than cultural Marxism is rooted in cultural reality. But people who represent cultural Marxists wield more influence now than constitutionalists. So you pom-pom girls on the edge of the cliff can rah-rah the Constitution all you want, but we need, you know, and that's another reason why suddenly talk radio seems a little tired. Because it's obviously, if you're talking about the same things in the same way, you're not alert to the urgency of the times. Let's go to Denise O'Leary. I'm always interested in what Denise has to say. In fact, I think Denise was present at that awful thing I went to in Ottawa. Denise says, Mark, in the last year and a half, I've learned more about my fellow citizens than in the previous 70 years. And the picture's grim. Old ladies wittering, masked, on their sofas, watching panic porn on TV, grateful for the latest lunacy, diminishing their civil liberties and their society in general. No one asks what really happened. They don't care what really happened. They can't care. They want the government to scare them good and then offer them a breath of fresh air someday. They feel sure they will survive that way. Many are probably still blaming Donald Trump. When I've tried pointing out obvious discrepancies in that line of reasoning, they act like they don't hear me. At bottom, they know something is wrong, but they trust government to get them out of it. The idea that government got them into it is a thought they can't think. If a problem started in China, that's all the more reason to cater to China, in their view, and to vote only for those who do so, dutifully wearing their masks. In the teeth of the wind off the ocean, they are sure of one thing. If they die, they will die mast. Yeah, and again, that's the only... That's another of those significant facts, I think, that people don't pay enough attention to. The enthusiasm of large numbers of our fellow citizens for these ridiculous regimes. They don't even care about the contradictory advice. They don't even care about the obvious absurdities. Like, I think it was the photograph on Monday. They showed Boris and Biden at the UN General Assembly, and they're giving a press conference. There's an Anglo-American press conference. And Biden and Boris are socially distanced and wearing masks at the press conference. The press conference itself broke up when basically in the middle of Boris talking, Biden's minders, terrified that he might have to answer a question from a British journalist, for which he didn't have the script, ordered everybody out of the room, ordered all the media out of the room halfway during Boris's thing. And all, of course, the media, being lapdogs, complied with it. So anyway, there's the two of them sitting there, masked up, whatever it is, 6 feet apart, socially distant. And then the next photograph shows Boris and Biden embracing each other without masks, Biden opening his huge jaw and spraying saliva all over Boris, and Boris doing the same to Biden. So what are we meant to... So even in the face of obvious concessions to the theatre of it all, people enjoy this mask regime and being ordered and bossed and bullied around by the government. And I think one of the strangest things about that is that everybody needs every society, I've often said this, a society needs a transcendent meaning. For most of the glorious period of Western civilization, the transcendent meaning was Christianity. It accounts for our most beautiful buildings. It accounts for our greatest music. It accounts for our finest paintings. The transcendent meaning of a society. And when you lose your faith, you have to have something else. You've got to fill that hole with something. And some people fill it with climate change, and some people fill it with transgender activism. But they're a bit specialist and boutique meanings of transcendence for large numbers of people. And so what we have seen the last year and a half is that what gives transcendent meaning to daily life is their faith in government. And again, you know, if you had said to me, for example, a year and a half ago, that the biggest pushbacks against this thing would be the Swedes, who said, I don't think so. I don't think we're going to go for this. So you want us to lock down for 2 weeks, but you're figuring it might take a bit more, 2 weeks to flatten the curve, might easily become 2 years to flatten the curve. Let me have a look at the... I don't think so. I don't think we're going to go for that. And if you then said, for example, the French, where there have been... Again, mass demonstrations against these things. You know, the cliche. Well, I don't know what we learn about this, but I think we learn that essentially the old views of left and right, which basically date back a couple of centuries now, perhaps are losing their applicability. And what I'm interested in, actually, is the cultural right. I'm not, you know, economic conservatism, so-called, fiscal conservatism, is going to seem terribly unimportant after the dollar collapses, which I think will probably be next February. And so what matters, I think the heart of conservatism isn't an economic argument. The heart of conservatism is cultural conservatism. Does a society have the right to maintain its own culture, its own way of life? Now, Denise is saying, actually, no. You can destroy everything about people's lives, including, you know, the monthly trip to the hairdresser, which wouldn't have seemed like the sort of thing that would be a priority to any government. But it actually is a priority for totalitarian governments, because the lesson of the last year and a half is that everything exists only on the say-so of government. And with very few exceptions, no one has pushed back against that. I mean, I read the editorial in the Australian Spectator, which is the sort of sub-edition of the UK Spectator that started a couple of years back. And to me, it was very depressing in their hostility to what are riots essentially born of frustration. We now have Australian police firing rubber bullets, as I think one tweeter said. Oh yeah, you know, it's like the what is it? It's like the silver bullets for vampires. It's like rubber bullets. You fire a rubber bullet at an Australian, and it will pierce him and get to the heart of the coronavirus and kill it. And that's the thing. There are millions and millions and millions. We've so prioritized security over the last century. And there are a lot of pillars that go into building that up. But if you eventually you accept the fact that you're a ward of the state in every respect, so that if the state licensed doctor says that your 7-year-old boy who likes to play with Barbie dolls, that's a sign that he's really a girl. So we're going to put him down for puberty blockers and shrivel up his penis and make him impotent, and eventually remove that penis and put a vagina in there. We're going to give him hormone growth implants so he can go. And if at some point it turns out to be just a phase he's going through, and 4 years later he wants to throw away his Barbies and play with G.I. Joe, well, tough. And people accept that, because what all these things have in common is the idea that it is the state that lends the imprimatur of officialdom to everything that happens, and diminishes the human being, so that the doctor's view of what's in the interests of little 7-year-old Jimmy counts for more than what is mummy and daddy's view of what's in the interests of little 7-year-old Jimmy. And again, I say to my friends on the American right, you know, I'm a conservative in everything. I don't have to. That's why, as I was saying the other day, I don't torture myself like these people used to do at National Review. I can never get over it. All the 20 most conservative rock songs in which they try to pretend to themselves, or the conservative underlying conservative message of Cardboard Man 37. No, I'm a conservative in all aspects of my life. And so for me, it's disturbing. It's disturbing when our the leaders of the, essentially when it comes to the transgender issues, the position of the right, for example, is, you know, look at this. They've got a story in the paper here about some woman who died of prostate cancer. Isn't that ridiculous? Oh, yeah. America's silent killer. There's a woman who died of prostate cancer. And their assumption is that everyone else will see the inherent absurdity of it. Well, if everyone else saw the inherent absurdity of it, you wouldn't have these strapping 6-foot-3 blokes beating women up on stage under the guise of ladies' sports, would you? So that ship has sailed. Most people don't see the obvious ridiculousness of it. And it happened. And so when the old COVID came along, We thought the same thing would apply, pointing out the obvious absurdity. Oh, look, here's all the people at the Emmys. Here's all the people at Barack Obama's parties. They're not wearing masks. Just the servants are wearing masks. Masks are for the little people. The elite, the A-listers, they can't pass COVID. They're celebrities, so they're immune to COVID because their glamour, their sheer Klieg lights of their glamour zaps the COVID and kills it as it approaches. And we thought that just pointing out, so we do the same thing we did with the transgender thing, even though it didn't work with the transgender thing. Most people actually do. And again, this is where your constitution and the hyper-rationalism doesn't do anything for you. As I said to Tucker, I think the monarchical principle lingers in any society, the idea of a group of people who operate on such a grand plane that they're not subject to all the little knots and irritations that we're subject to. And throughout most human history, that has been a monarch, that's been a king or an emperor. Now, in the democratic age, the monarchy can least get away with that kind of behaviour because people resent it. So that's why when you're taking a train or you're flying on a plane, you'll often run into members of the royal family carrying on just like anybody else, because they know that if you're a prince or a duchess, you can't get away with behaving like that. But when you have the democratic age meets the mass media age, and so you have this celebrity culture where people actually think. People watch the Emmys. People watch Oprah and George Clooney flying in for Barack Obama's party. And they actually think these people exist on a loftier plane than a prince and a duchess. And that they actually do deserve. They don't get resentful about the fact that the people without masks are whooping it up and having a good time. You know, these are that again is something that the American right has to have a serious response to. The obvious absurdity hasn't worked with the trans. The trans issue is really the one through which all others can be seen, because it is so. We're looking at someone who used to be a guy, and he has now decided he identifies as a woman. And he's beating the crap out of a girl, a little girl, on stage. And we're supposed to applaud that. You know, the UCL, what's it called? Not UCLA. What's the civil liberty? ACLU. UCLA, ACLU. I'm sick of acronyms, by the way. Screw. When we have the revolution and we start to build society from the ground up, I want an end to all these acronyms. Anyway, I got the UCLA and the ACLU. I don't care for either of them. But the ACLU released a quote from Ruth Bader Ginsburg in support of abortion today, because they were saying that, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had recognized that all these pro-life people were just basically trampling on women. But they couldn't actually use the word woman. So they had to edit Ruth Bader Ginsburg and replace every place where she'd said woman with person, every place where she'd said she with they, every place where she'd said her with their. So in other words, a quote from Ruth Bader Ginsburg about how opposition to abortion diminishes women ended up as a Ruth Bader Ginsburg quote from which women are eliminated. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's been dead a year, and she's already irrelevant. She can't be quoted without bowdlerizing the quotes to make plain that now all over the world, men are getting abortions. It's a man's right to choose. A man can have a partial birth abortion. The old fallopian tube that Giuseppe Fallopi discovered when he was on the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria, and the G-spot discovered by Count von G-spot, And now that's the point. The G-spot is chiefly useful because that's the point where the gynecologist reaches in with the forceps and crushes the baby's head so that the baby is not technically born before he is killed. And you can't even talk about that as a woman's right to choose anymore. You know, there's so much opportunity here. Because you have a completely incoherent left. And yet, by comparison with the constitutional fetishists, talking the same old, no one is able to lay a glove on the internal, to go all Marxian, on the internal contradictions of wokeness. It's pathetic. It's really pathetic. Anyway, that point of Denise's is absolutely correct on that. Let's see. What's this here? Canuck in Mourning says, hi, Mark. Does the Canadian political climate allow for a Trumpian figure? I know you've got a favourable view of Maxime Bernier, but his party only got 5% of the vote and no seats. Is someone like him taking over even viable, or are we doomed to the Shears and O'Tooles as the Conservative standard bearers? Look, I'm a believer in the motto of Britain's SAS, the special forces there, who dares wins. If you don't dare, you're not going to win. O'Toole didn't dare and he lost. Andrew Scheer didn't dare and he lost. These are not people, these are not leaders. They don't lead. They're followers at one remove of the precepts of liberalism of the conventional wisdom. Now, Maxime Bernier faces a steep climb, but actually 5%, 6% in Ontario, Canada's most populous province, is not unimpressive when you consider that this guy was excluded from the leadership debates, which is about the only attention anyone paid to that election in Canada. The thing about it is, you know, I would look at it this way. You don't win just by winning election to a national legislature. Nigel Farage never won election to a national legislature, but he's the most consequential figure in British politics since Mrs. Thatcher, because he actually blew up the principal pillar of Britain's post-war foreign policy, which was membership of the European Union. There's a lot of... The fact is, Maxime Bernier got enough that the Conservative Party, which shouldn't have allowed him to leave, which should have kept him inside the tent pissing out, because he's done a bloody good job of being outside the tent pissing in, they should take into account those numbers. And it means taking into account the way you diminish the 6% in Ontario, which keeps the Conservative Party from winning seats... certainly in the liberal heartland of the Toronto suburbs, he forces the Tories to take account of issues of concern to his voters. Because if you ignore all the issues of concern to them, like mass immigration or whatever, you're going to wind up with 6% getting to 8% and 8% getting to 10%, and eventually it's gonna kill you. John Weston says, mismanaged decline. Is it worse for the USA or for its allies in the rest of the world? Well, as I said earlier, John, we're all heading to the same place, which is the bottom of the cliff, and it's going to be bloody miserable when we land there. So you don't want to be the first country to land there, because at least if you're the 17th country to go over the cliff, you'll have all the others to land upon. But I think it is going to be worse for the United States. I mentioned last time, I think we were talking about the size of nations, which is the title of a book, talking about how you... there is an optimal size of to nations, the most prosperous in terms of GDP per capita and all those other kinds of measurements tend to be small places, not just really small like Singapore, but small by American standards, such as Norway and Switzerland. And I think if you have, as I was talking yesterday when we were running these demographic numbers, that if you have a nation of 400 million falling apart, it's going to be a lot more convulsive than Norway or Sweden or Denmark falling apart. So the other point I'd sort of slightly jib at, because I was thinking about the other day. I was rereading what I'd written in about decline in After America. And in particular, Charles Krauthammer's line that decline is a choice. And decline is a choice, but this isn't what we're going through. Look at that border. Look at Del Rio. Look at that bridge. That is, and in fact, that is almost a literal example of what's happening in America, because I don't know if anyone's ever taken that road over from Mexico. But when you head north, you go across the bridge, which is over the Rio Grande. So you think, oh, I see. OK, so this is a bridge over a river. I understand that, because if you've got a river and you want to get across it, you need to build a bridge. But the bridge continues for reasons I don't fully understand, as a raised superstructure on the other side of the river for about half a mile before you come to the CBP, the Customs and Immigration Post, which is kind of half a mile north of the Rio Grande. And so it's interesting that. And if you look at what those Haitians are doing when they walk across the river, that bit they're in under the underpass is a kind of no man's land before you get to the American fence, which is actually set half a mile in from the American border. And it looks a little odd. And the Haitians have drawn the obvious conclusion from it, which is that the sovereignty of the United States has been abandoned in that little bit under the underpass between the river and the border post up the road. The writ of the United States does not run there. And so they've drawn the obvious conclusion, and they've set up camp, as in the Camp of the Saints, in that territory. And that too is symbolic. It's symbolic of the surrender of sovereignty that is the tolerance of illegal immigration. You know, that's what it is. That's what it is. The surrender of sovereignty, to say we're not a sovereign nation, because a sovereign nation is for the people who are already there, whoever they are. You might not like some of them. Some of them might be racist. I tried to make this point on Tucker once and got clobbered by the Twitter crowd. You might not like some of them. Some of them might be racist. Some of them might be serial killers. Some of them might be drug-addled deadbeats. But they're who you are. They're the people who are lawfully abiding in your nation as it exists right now. And you can't have a more fundamental dissolution of sovereignty than just opening up the borders like that. Again, it's not, it's different from what's happening in Britain or in Europe. In Britain, for example, you know, the 1948 British Nationality Act made a quarter of the world's population British subjects. It operated on the principle that a British subject in Kingston, Jamaica, or Kingston, Ontario, is no different from a British subject in Kingston on Thames. Now, we all know there's a little more to it than that, but that at least is a legal and philosophical underpinning for why there are Indian and Pakistani corner shops in every town in the United Kingdom. Now, likewise, you could make a similar argument for France with North Africans and all kinds of things. You don't often see what you do in the United States. And again, I ask
members of the American right, so-called, people who say they're conservative, to start thinking about this in more serious terms. What has happened in the United States is that we don't have to do much. We're not being asked to do much except to take the left at their word, which is that they make it plain that they hate everything about the United States. They think its founders were evil men. They think their founders were evil racists who kept slaves. They tell us this every day of the week. They even, agencies of the United States government now, put trigger warnings on the United States Constitution. So tell me that, you constitutional fetishist. When the United States government puts trigger warnings on its own constitution as a triggering racist document, you know, so when you keep talking about the Constitution, where do you think that's going to get you? The fact is, the left is quite upfront about this. They hate the country. They hate it. They hate your country, your constitution, your founding fathers. They hate the men you put statues up to all over the country. They hate the men you named the grade schools after all over the country, and they want it all gone. And dissolving the southern border operates in the interests of that. And they have, it's not decline, this. That was the question from John Weston, mismanaged decline. Charles Krauthammer said, decline is a choice, but national suicide is also a choice. And you look at any image from that Del Rio bridge, and it's national suicide. And again, I listen to the so-called conservative, why hasn't Secretary, what's their name, the Homeland Security guy? Who cares? He's just some diversity pick from the Biden thing. He's obviously not up to the job. Doesn't matter whether he's the first Muslima transgender to be appointed Homeland Security Secretary. He's not up to it. And it's not about this. Oh, Kamala. Oh, we're totally owning the libs because we're saying, when was the last time Kamala? You know, I don't care about 2022. I don't care. But if you do care about 2022, are you really so sure that just sitting back and figuring that Biden's mismanagement, so-called, is so obvious, will be enough to get you over the finish line? Because I don't see it that way. I think you've got to do more. I think you've got to have a vision. I think you've got to have a vision. And I don't get any sense in that. I don't get any sense of that, and that's, you know, upsetting to me. Oh, Derek in Dubai says, greetings from the Trucial States. When I heard you rattle off the time zones, which I enjoy almost as much as your subdued Durham report intros, I had to look up the Trucial States. When I discovered they are the current United Arab Emirates, I exclaimed, hey, that's me. Derek, you have made in Dubai. Derek in Dubai, you have made my day. I am a serious old school imperialist. And, you know, I mentioned, I think it was to Tucker a couple of weeks back when I was doing his long form show. And he was asking me about these Gambians that I spent a couple of nights with, actually sleeping on a bunk in their room, which was a bit heady for my tastes because they tended to speak and smoke an awful lot of pot in Germany a couple of years back. And they were great guys that we drank a lot of beer. They smoked their pot and we sat out in the sun drinking beer and growing very drowsy. And it made them laugh because I insisted on referring to Banjul, the capital of the Gambia, as Bathurst, which is what it was called before independence. And that's how conservative I am. So, So I'm operating. So, you know, the notions of conservatism can change. But I've always preferred I never really cared for the name the United Arab Emirates because it sounds like some. But I thank you, Derek, in Dubai for bringing that up. That was a fun thing to get from you. Let's see what else we got. Joseph Dornish writes, so despite your complaining about the Republicans not doing anything under Paul Ryan, they did force sequestration on the Obama administration, which I think was actually a pretty good success, and I wish Trump would have kept it. Yeah. When I'm critical of Paul Ryan, Paul Ryan's always been personally very pleasant to me, and he claims to have read my books, which is always something an author likes to hear, and he's gone on stage and said that he's read my books, which, again, an author always appreciates. And there are, when Paul Ryan was the budget guy, and he had that one very memorable moment where he was talking about 2037, I think it was, or whatever year. He says he's showing the trend lines. And he goes, and after 2037, we don't really have to worry about anything because there's not going to be anything such as the United States anymore. And I thought that was really good. And I like that. And I quoted it favorably. And the budget sequestration, which he proposed, was an automatic thing in which budget cuts. There was a hard cap on government spending that was automatically triggered. And it was the usual thing that Democrats didn't like it for all the social stuff, and Republicans like Lindsey Graham didn't like it because they wanted boots on the ground in all 200 countries on the face of this earth. So neither party liked it, and Paul Ryan, as the fiscal conservative, managed to get that imposed. Now, I'm trying to get an order of priorities here. I think America is the only one. You know, the consequences of shutting down your economies are going to be very severe for Western Europe and for those British settler nations because they don't operate under the global reserve currency, whereby they can basically print their way out of whatever problems they run into on the huge spending that's gone on while their economies have been shut down. But America can get away with that. You know, my main interest in the economy, right, as I said, I think at some point very, very soon the Chinese are going to yank the rug out from under the dollar. And at that point, it's all over. We'll probably be plunged into civil war. There will certainly be mass violence. This is what we were talking about earlier. There's the happy note to end on, as it were. There's going to be mass violence. There's going to be blood running in the streets and all the rest of it once the dollar collapses. Nobody's got anything. The supply chains are totally broken down because this is a nation that imports everything and it won't be able to pay for what it imports. And so the thugs that in Chicago, that right now where they're mainly shooting black kids at intersections, will be moving to the more fashionable parts of town to shoot the wealthy white people's kids. So it's going to be bloody and it's going to be unpleasant. But we need more than, you know, what we need right now is we need fiscal conservatism and we need cultural conservatism, which is slightly different from social conservatism. It operates on a broader front. And we need candidates who are both fiscal conservatives and cultural conservatives, which is what I mean when I'm sitting around shooting the breeze with Gambians and talking about Bathurst. And if we don't get both, then we're screwed. And you know, let me know when you find persuasive candidates like that. Because you can spend a lot of money sending money now to sendmoneynow.com, or you can actually do what The Milton Friedman thing says is, and which is correct, is that instead of abandon, you know, where did transgenderism come from? Tal Backman has been running a series on this at Stein Online. Transgenderism wasn't taken up by the Democrats. They didn't legislate it in, California in some school board and then watch it spread all over the country. No, it originated in the cultural sphere. On the ground, Republicans don't even play on. I mean, it drives me bonkers. I did that Canadian election on Monday, you know, because I felt I had to for our Canadian. Oh, yes. What do you think of so-and-so? Who's he? I've never heard of him. Well, he's the deputy finance minister of wherever. You know, in the end, the Milton Friedman thing is the easier thing to do. Change the culture. Because if you don't change the culture, you wind up just with reactive conservatives just reacting to whatever's going on. Thank you for all your questions. We'll get to some of them elsewhere as we proceed in the next week at Stein Online. Don't forget, let me work this out. In about 4 hours' time, I'm going to be on 7-8 Radio in the UK with the Thursday repeat of Stein's Song of the Week. That is 9 p.m. British summertime. You can listen to it anywhere on the planet by going to serenade-radio.com. And we hope you will tune in because it will be a nice palate cleanser after the toxic pessimism of this show. I'm not, in fact, pessimistic because The way to do this is to live in truth in your small way. If every time you bite your tongue at your kid's school's ice cream social, if instead of biting your tongue and going along with the crap, it's important to do. It's important to do that because all the big ideas started out small. And the thing about it is if you nip them in the bud at the school board, if you nip them in the bud at the municipal level, at the county level, at the state level, then they won't get to the thing. Now, we're up against a globalist elite here, a globalist elite. And that's, again, where the parochialism of the American right doesn't help. And I'll give you one last example of that. The horrible thing, the great the braggadocio of the crapped-out superpower and its totally incompetent military, when Thoroughly Modern Millie decided that he'd droned some guy on the way out the door in Afghanistan, and he droned, in fact, a charity worker and his six lovely kids. And people have said to me, why didn't you write about that, son? Why haven't you been writing about that? Oh, we can own the libs. We can own Biden. We can... Well, actually, I wrote about it 3 weeks ago, and it was on the BBC when I saw whatever she's called, Yalda Hakim, interviewing the uncle of those kids, holding up pictures of those kids, holding up pictures of their American visas. 3 weeks ago on the BBC. 3 weeks. And then 3 weeks after that, that's when I wrote about it. 3 weeks after that, the New York Times covers it. And this is the reaction. The American right lives by reaction alone. And then suddenly all the conservative talk shows start covering the murder, by the droning, the mass droning of these kids by Thoroughly Modern Millie. Why was I the only one who saw it on the BBC? I mean, the thing about it, the rest of the world knew you'd drone those kids 3 weeks before Americans did. So they were, if there had ever been a time for you to stop being so parochial and actually hang it around the neck of Joe Biden when it mattered, so ask him why. That was 24 hours. The strike was on Sunday night. Monday morning, that uncle was showing pictures of his dead nieces and nephews. But the American right, which claims the New York Times is crap, waits for the New York Times to run a story on it before they then decide to go all excited about it. The parochialism doesn't help. You know, here's what we need. We need a globalism of nationalists, which requires conservatives, who are the minority almost everywhere now in the big security COVID forever state, but it requires American conservatives to find common ground with Danish conservatives, to find common ground with Slovene conservatives, to find common ground with New Zealand conservatives, and to have actually a globalist nationalist movement that can conquer the globalists. Okay, we'll see you with all our other stuff as the end of the week approaches and the weekend becomes clear. And I tell you what, with the weekend, we start to think about all the pleasures of life that are not about sending money now to sendmoneynow.com. And maybe we should go out with a piano lesson today. Hey, Jessica, do you remember the day I came over to your place for my first piano lesson?
Oh, yes. And I got you to start out with this little exercise. Yeah, that's the one. You still remember it?
Yeah. But what happens next?
Shift over and I'll show you.
Yeah, that's it. Jessica?
Yes?
It's getting tiring down here. Can we swap?
Oh, Mark. You know I like to be on top.
Oh, come on. Just for once.
Yeah, but you'll fall off if we try to switch in midstream.
Oh, please.
Okay, but don't lose the place.
Now, if I just get my knee up on the stool and get my right hand on top of the piano...
And I'll slide under your left arm. And now...
See? I knew we could do it. Nobody spotted a thing.
Oh, Mark, this is so romantic. Just you and me and the music.
Now all we need are the words.
Don't hold back, Mark. Sing 'em.
I really can't
baby,
stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
I gotta go
baby,
away.
Baby, it's cold outside.
Well, okay. But just another 8 bars. Here we are, out of cigarettes.
Holding hands and yawning, look how late it gets.
Two sleepy people
by dawn's early light.
And too much in love to say.
I love you, a bushel and a peck.
A bushel and a peck, and it beats me all to heck.
Beats me all to heck, how I'll ever tend the farm.
Ever tend the farm when I want to keep my arm about you.
About you. Cause I love you, a bushel and a peck. You bet your pretty neck I do. A little late this year. Mighty fine music.
And if I were a bell, I'd go
ding-a-dong-a-ding-a-dong.
So I was standing on the corner watching all the girls go by. Standing on the corner giving all the girls the eye.
I've let a pair of arms enslave me oft times before. It's more than just a thrill you gave me. Yes, more, much more. Heart and soul, I fell in love with you. Heart and soul, the way a fool would do. Because you held me tight and stole a kiss in the night.
Heart and soul, I beg to be adored. Lost control and
tumbled overboard gladly. That magic night we kissed there in the moon mist.
Oh, but your lips were thrilling,
much too thrilling.
Never before were mine so strangely willing.
And now I see what one embrace can do. Look at me, it's got me loving you madly. That little kiss you stole held all my heart and soul.
And now one of London's finest musicians, Jeff Eales, is going to demonstrate his mastery of the keyboard with a piano solo like you have never heard.
Stand well back. He's gonna blow the roof off this joint.
Wow! Those lessons are really paying off.
Control
and tumbled overboard gladly. The magic night we kissed.
Bum ba bum bum a dip da dip dip a dun da dun dun a dingity dingity. Bum ba bum bum a dip da dip dip a dun da dun dun a dingity dong di dong.
Now I see what one embrace can do.
Look at me, it's got me loving you madly. That little kiss you stole held all my heart and soul.
Held all my heart and soul.
Held all my heart and soul.
Most love songs are about new love, heady, intoxicating, urgent. But on Stein's Song of the Week this week, we have a song for old, familiar love, content, placid, tranquil, unexciting, routine. Good heavens, I'm nodding off in the middle of the promo. But we'll do our best to pep up the subject with Joe Stafford, Peggy Lee, Guy Lombardo, Eric Clapton and more this Sunday at 5:30 on 7-8 Radio.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.